It is a distinct pleasure to introduce today's speaker, Martin Filler. Before I do so, two housekeeping announcements. The first is predictable. Please silence your cell phones and any other noise-making devices you may have. Second, Mr. Filler will be signing copies of all three books in the series Makers of Modern Architecture following his talk. Martin Filler's writings on architecture, art, and design, more than 1,000 articles to date. I thought that might have been a typo. It's not a typo. I'll read it again. More than 1,000 articles to date have appeared in publications, newspapers, scholarly journals, and exhibition catalogs in the United States, Europe, and Japan, including some 50 pieces for the New York Times. From 1999 to 2003, he was architecture critic for the New Republic, and in that latter year was elected a fellow of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. Filler is perhaps best known for his long essays on modern architecture that have appeared in the New York Review of Books since 1985. For all of us who care about modern architecture, its history, its major practitioners, its achievements, and its failures, Filler is the go-to, must-read, cannot-miss-this, what would Martin Filler say, critic of this generation. Robert Hughes praised his essays as, quote, by far the most intelligent and shapely writing on architecture done in recent years. Estimating what he called, quote, the strength of Filler's writing, historian George Baird has said, it seems to me he can lay claim to the mantle of the late Ada Louise Huxtable, the most admired critic of recent times. This evening, Martin Filler will address Makers of Modern Architecture, A Critic's Journey. Join me in welcoming him.
Good evening. It is a singular honor for me to address the shareholders of the Athenaeum of Philadelphia and their guests on the occasion of this venerable institution's 204th annual meeting. In the words of the Frank Sinatra record that I learned to do the foxtrot to in dancing class at age 11, you make me feel so young. I'd like to especially thank Peter Kahn, the Athenaeum's director, and Linda Hollick, publisher of New York Review Books and publisher of my Makers of Modern Architecture series, for making it possible for me to speak to you tonight, as well as Mike Seneca for his technical support in this presentation. This is a homecoming of sorts for me, and I'm put in mind of the evening in June 2001 when I and my wife, the architectural historian Rosemary Hogg Bletter, were invited to attend the opening at the Philadelphia Museum of Art's exhibition, Out of the Ordinary, the Architecture and Design of Robert Venturi and Denise Scott Brown. We were surprised to find ourselves seated at the top table in the museum's grand hall, where I was placed between Judith Rodin, then president of Penn, and the museum's director, the incomparable and deeply missed Anne Darnancourt. As I looked out at the view down the parkway, I told Anne that because I had grown up near Philadelphia, it was tremendously moving for me to be back at the institution where I first learned to love art. Anne, whom I already knew from the New York art world, and whom I often used to run into at Wagner evenings at the Metropolitan Opera with her husband, Joe Rischel, asked me where on the main line I was from, to which I replied, Camden. I was flattered that she did not fall off her seat at this revelation, and I dedicate my talk tonight to her memory. Before I begin, I would like to acknowledge a great friend of mine in the audience. I first met Eugene Lefevre 52 years ago during his freshman and my sophomore year at Columbia. As you will hear in a few minutes, we were both propelled on our career paths by a particularly inspiring architectural history course there. 8 days ago, Gene turned 70, which gives me the excuse to laud his exceptional contributions to the architectural character and civic life of Philadelphia. His first triumph in 1989 as president of Growth Properties with his then partner, Michael DiPaolo, was to save the marvelous Litt Brothers block from destruction and to transform it into a model of historic preservation through adaptive reuse. 30 years later, it remains a textbook example of how we should deal with neglected and endangered architectural treasures in our inner cities. His subsequent rescues of other historic structures, most notably the Robert Morris House, only add to his importance to this city. Because Gene chose to become a real estate developer rather than practice as a design architect, which he is perfectly qualified to do, he has always self-deprecatingly told me that he's, quote, gone over to the dark side, possibly imagining that I think less of him for not aspiring to become the next Lou Kahn. On the contrary, I now rank him, along with such enlightened developers of an earlier generation that included James Rouse and J. Irwin Miller, as an exemplar of how commercial interests can enrich a community through architectural quality and respect for the past. I congratulate Gene on his milestone birthday, and I thank him for a half century of friendship. No child dreams of becoming an architecture critic when she or he grows up, any more so than aspiring to become a tax attorney, a urologist, or a quality control chemist, however beneficial those specialized pursuits may be to society. Biographers tell us that master builders from Frank Lloyd Wright to Frank Gehry were encouraged to become architects through imaginative construction play as small children. Wright's ambitious mother gave him Friedrich Froebel's pioneering educational toys in rural Wisconsin, and Frank Gehry's intuitive grandmother plied him with odds and ends from the Goldberg family's hardware store in Toronto. But few of us who merely write about architecture decided to do so at a comparably tender age. By and large, we have come to our current occupation via circuitous routes, but by no means are we inevitably failed or unrequited architects, despite the many practicing architects who fancy themselves to be qualified critics. Here you see a photograph of me half a lifetime ago at age 35 with my wife, the architectural historian Rosemary Haug Bletter, who regrettably could not be here tonight because of a speaking engagement of her own this afternoon in New York, and Philip Johnson, as we signed the release form for our 1983 documentary film Beyond Utopia, Changing Attitudes in American Architecture. For more on Johnson, see my article, The Godfather, in the current issue of the New York Review of Books, dated April 18th, available at finer news stores and books and newsstands everywhere, and online at www.nybooks.com. Looking back at age 70, it seems clear to me that I showed an unusual interest in architecture long before I began to study it, its history in college, and then to write about it soon thereafter. However, although I have a freakishly retentive memory, my very earliest recollections of architecture can be spotty. For example, I know that I went to Charles Follen McKim's Pennsylvania Station in New York in 1953, when I was five, to see my grandparents off on their annual winter in Florida. Frustratingly, I can only remember the train, the streamlined silver meteor, and have no recollection of the monumental building itself, which only a decade after my visit was torn down, giving impetus to the historic preservation movement. It was not until my parents moved from New York in 1954 that my consciousness of architecture began to emerge. Some of my most formative impressions were shaped by Philadelphia, where my father, a printer for the federal government, was transferred to work at what was then known as the Philadelphia Quartermaster Depot, and which is now named in contemporary Pentagonese the Defense Logistics Agency Troop Support. But rather than settling in Philadelphia, my mother chose a neighborhood across the Delaware River in Camden, in large part, she said, because of the brand new elementary school which I would be able to attend there. Byron H. Edwards and Alfred Green's Francis X. McGraw School of 1952-1953 is a single-story, flat-roofed, yellow brick structure with a meandering ground plan, pylon-like, freestanding chimney several times the building's height, and vestigial Art Deco detailing. The architecture has much in common with remarkable series of public schools produced during the 1920s and 1930s for the Dutch city of Hilversum by Willem Marinus Dudok, its municipal architect. Dudok's warm and inviting, yet unmistakably contemporary architecture falls about halfway on a stylistic spectrum between the contemporaneous red brick traditionalism of the Amsterdam School and the cool abstraction of the De Stael group, and displays a humane side of modern architecture often overlooked by its opponents. However, the best known work of Edwards and Green was Camden City Hall of 1929 to 1931. This stripped classical composition with a central high-rise tower and much lower symmetrical wings is reminiscent of John Parkinson, John C. Austin, and Albert C. Martin Sr.'s Los Angeles City Hall of 1926 to 28. Along with even earlier prototypes, such as Bertram Goodhue's Nebraska State Capitol of 1920 to 1932, the civic skyscraper format offered a modern alternative to the domed Beaux-Arts classical model that had been endlessly repeated for American governmental seats from the United States Capitol to the Camden County Courthouse of 1906, which we see here, which was torn down to make way for a Litt Brothers department store branch that was completed in 1956 and whose grand opening I attended at age 8. Of course, the most obvious nearby reference point for Edwards and Green's scheme is Philadelphia's City Hall of 1871 to 1901 by John MacArthur Jr. and Thomas U. Walter, the latter of whom designed the dome and outermost wings of the United States Capitol in Washington. City Hall, with its curious French Second Empire clock tower, remained the world's tallest habitable structure from its topping out in 1894 until it was superseded by Ernest Flagg's Singer Building of 1906 to 1908 in New York. However, the mid-rise pavilion of City Hall that terminates the Western Vista on Market Street with its exaggerated mansard roof and upwardly flaring acroteria reminiscent of winged pagoda eaves, to me as a child look exotically Chinese. I had heard much about Center City's recently demolished Chinese Wall, the masonry trestle that led trains into Frank Furness's Broad Street Station of 1892 to 93, which was flattened in 1953 to make way for Penn Center. I wondered as a child if this strange building was somehow related to the Chinese Wall, especially on Sundays when my parents and I would drive in from Camden to eat at our favorite Chinatown restaurant, the Dragon Gate on Race Street. The gray granite friezes of Camden City Hall are inscribed with quotations from the Bible, Shakespeare, and Walt Whitman, the last of whom lived his final 8 years in a small wood-framed house, still miraculously intact, a few blocks away at 328 Mickle Street. The City Hall excerpt from Whitman poem reads, "In a dream, I saw a city invincible." Yet his utopian vision now rings hollow in light of the urban disaster Camden became soon after I left for college, and which it remains to this day. Nothing has spoken to me of the city's precipitous decline and fall more personally than the disappearance of a building that was a major emotional touchstone for my childhood. Dudley Grange, an Eastlake-style fieldstone mansion on a 30-acre East Camden estate, was built during the 1870s by Thomas Haynes Dudley, an early political supporter of Abraham Lincoln, who appointed him U.S. consul to Liverpool during the Civil War. There, Dudley was in charge of an American intelligence gathering operation to counteract support for the Confederacy in Europe, subject of David Hepburn Milton's intriguing 2003 book, Lincoln's Spymaster. In 1926, 33 years after Dudley's death, the house was converted into a branch of the Camden Free Public Library, and three decades later, it became my favorite refuge. The interiors of Dudley Grange often recur in my dreams. And in my mind's eye, I can still see those high-ceiling rooms with their deep alcoves, wainscot paneling, parquet floors, sliding pocket doors, and carved marble chimney pieces, the source of my abiding fondness for Victorian architecture. I love nothing more than to be able to retreat into one of the library's capacious window seats with a book that could propel me far away from my unhappy home life. When the economic fortunes of that once thriving blue-collar city plummeted during the 1970s, a perfect storm of industrial decline, white flight, and cuts in federal funding to cities, the Dudley Grange Library was closed. In 1980, a fire of mysterious origins gutted the abandoned mansion. As Camden teetered on the brink of bankruptcy, the insurance payout for the building's loss was not used to restore it, but instead to cover a single municipal payroll. The city invincible had become the city insolvent, and then the city impossible. But I date my true architectural awakening to not long after my sixth birthday, soon after we arrived in Camden. My mother still harbored Depression-era suspicions about the trustworthiness of New Jersey banking institutions for some strange reason, and decided that rather than putting her money into any Camden bank, which she simply could not fathom, she would instead open an account at the Philadelphia Savings Fund Society. Thus, I duly accompanied her on the public service bus that crossed the Delaware River Bridge of 1922 to 1926, which was designed by the engineers Ralph Majeski and Leon Mosieff with the architect Paul-Philippe Cray. Cray, of course, was a great classicist who designed the Rodin Museum on Benjamin Franklin Parkway and is now best remembered for having been Louis Kahn's Penn architecture professor and his first employer. When we arrived at 12th and Market Street, I got my initial view of George Howe and William Lescaze's 36-story PSF building of 1929 to 1932, the first international-style skyscraper in the United States and an enduring masterpiece of high-rise design. Even though I had already seen much taller buildings in Manhattan, I can still vividly recall how my heart leapt up as we stepped through the front door of PSFS and into the soaring 52-foot-high entry lobby with its walls surfaced in polished gray granite, banks of stairs and escalators that zoomed up to the landing, and a minimalist clock built right into the wall. How did they do that, I wondered. Here was my first visceral response to great architecture. At the top of the escalator and behind a screen wall of glass awaited the double-height main banking hall, a true piano nobile, if there ever was one in all of modern architecture. That vast room, a thrilling 63-foot span of space interrupted by internal columns, overlooked the bustle of Market Street through a floor-to-ceiling window wall that curved all the way around to 12th Street. The only other time I had had such a palpable reaction to architecture was a year earlier, when I went with my family to Radio City Music Hall to see Vincent Minnelli's The Bandwagon and was enraptured by Donald Deske's 60-foot-high grand foyer, a populist pleasure palace whose polychromatic Art Deco exuberance was the polar opposite of Howe and Lescaze's monochromatic international-style restraint. During another memorable day in Philadelphia, sometime after that, I had a similar epiphany on the bus home to Camden. As I looked out of the window on North Broad Street, just before the right turn onto Race Street and back towards the bridge, I caught a breathtaking glimpse of the facade of Frank Furness's Pennsylvania Academy of Fine Arts of 1871 to 1876. Its astonishing billboard-like facade, a dazzling Victorian panoply of rich color, complex pattern, and varied texture, was unlike anything I had ever seen before. "What is that?" I asked my mother, who replied, accurately enough, "That's called decoration." Little did she or I know that I had randomly spotted the early masterpiece of a major American master. Even less were we aware that along with the recent loss of Broad Street Station, Furness's built legacy had suffered a more devastating blow when several other of his works were destroyed to make way for the newly created Independence Mall and Historical Park. For more on Furness, look for my essay on him in the New York Review of Books later this year. When I entered junior high school, as public middle school was known back then, my understanding of architecture took a quantum leap forward thanks to the writing of Ada Louise Huxtable in the New York Times, which I was exposed to because of the free student subscriptions provided to schools in the tri-state New York, New Jersey, Connecticut radius of the paper's prime readership. Several years before Huxtable was formally named the Times' first architecture critic in 1963, I began devouring her lucid, provocative, and often irreverently funny reviews of the period's new buildings, as well as her longer think pieces on urban redevelopment, historic landmarks, and zoning laws. In 1963, aged 15, I bought my first book on the subject, a Pelican paperback of Nicholas Pevsner's An Outline of European Architecture, specifically because I was intrigued by its reproduction of a ground plan of a German Rococo pilgrimage church by Balthasar Neumann, comprised of three interlocking ovals, something I'd never seen before. I am probably discovered this perfect introductory text to architecture at the newly opened Moorestown Mall, which only recently did I learn was designed by John Graham Jr., the architect of Seattle's Space Needle, Small World. Under the influence of Huxtable and Pevsner, I began to observe the built environment much more closely. Even in Camden, which had nothing like the architectural riches of Philadelphia, I'd occasionally notice something of real significance. One example was a housing complex that I walked past daily on my way to junior high school, Westfield Acres of 1936 to 1938, built by the New Deal's Public Works Administration, just to the north of Dudley Grange. It caught my eye because of the unusual way in which the second and third floors of the three-story units, a total of 18 structures spread out on a 25-acre site, were hoisted above ground level on thin pipe-like columns that only much later would I learn are called pilotis, and were most famously employed by Le Corbusier at his Villa Savoye of 1928 to 1931 in Poissy near Paris. Westfield Acres' architect was the Philadelphia-based Oskar Stanarov, much admired for his and Alfred Kastner's Carl Mackley houses of 1933 to 1934 in the city's Juniata section, a development illustrated in many accounts of early modern social housing. Today, Stanarov is most often recalled for his partnership with Louis Kahn from 1942 to 1947, when they collaborated on some fine wartime housing schemes. A few years before the Mackley houses, Stanarov traveled back to his native Frankfurt to study the new workers' housing estates built there during the 1920s under the aegis of the city's chief architect and master planner, Ernst May, whose influence on him seems direct when we compare those exemplary Weimar German developments alongside Stanarov's ensembles in Philadelphia and Camden. Indeed, Westfield Acres, like all public housing at the time, was racially segregated, but it was considered significant enough to be included in the Museum of Modern Art's 1936 exhibition, Architecture and Government Housing. But it was torn down in the first years of the new millennium after decades of neglect, as government subsidies were slashed and public housing projects across the nation descended into squalor. Neoconservative commentators have insisted that modern high-rise housing projects, such as Minoru Yamasaki's Pruitt-Igoe apartments of 1950 to 1956 in St. Louis failed and ultimately had to be demolished because of the inherent inhumanity of modern architecture in general and tall buildings in particular. But in the case of both the high-rise Pruitt-Igoe and low-rise Westfield Acres, these thoughtfully designed slum clearance schemes were much loved by their grateful initial inhabitants and functioned perfectly well for many years thereafter until the wholesale withdrawal of government-supported social programs essentially killed public housing in America. Tellingly, in 2000, the Westfield Acres site was leveled and rebuilt by Penrose Properties with a mix of privately owned single-family houses, market-level rentals, and low-income units. It was fancifully renamed Baldwin's Run, a moniker that reminds me of a suburban subdivision or a TV soap opera. Designed in a watered-down version of the neo-traditional new urbanism style that was fashionable in the 1980s and 1990s, Baldwin's Run caters to the American assumption that the general public automatically prefers old-fashioned forms of domestic architecture to any modern design. Proving the opposite, Ernst Mai's Frankfurt housing estates, which have been scrupulously maintained since the 1920s, remain highly sought after places to live 9 decades after they were completed and are now considered cultural landmarks, the opposite of America's disposable architectural culture. A family connection made Columbia my first choice for college. My grandfather's cousin was the Columbia physics professor, I.I. Robbie, whose discovery of nuclear magnetic resonance gave the world radar, the MRI, and the microwave oven, and won him the 1944 Nobel Prize in Physics. But I was further drawn there by the university's imposing architecture. During my first visit to Columbia, for an East Coast high school debate tournament in 1965, I was bowled over by Charles Follow McKim's comprehensive campus design, dominated by his majestic Lowe Library of 1895 to 1897. A year later, I was accepted as a member of the class of 1970, with or without the intercession of Uncle Rob, as I called him, I still do not know. During my sophomore year, I heard from my new friend Jean Lefevre about a charismatic young instructor named Eugene Santomasso, whose modern architecture survey course was attracting hundreds of undergraduates because of his uncanny ability to bring the building art vividly to life. I was immediately captivated both by the subject and Mr. Santomasso's teaching, which he closely patterned on that of the great architectural historian Vincent Scully, with whom he in turn had studied as an undergraduate at Yale. Scully, who died 2 years ago at 97, is renowned for his mesmerizing lecture style and attracting generations of Yale non-art history majors with his spellbinding lectures. The ripple effect of Scully's influence on those future civic and business leaders, many of whom became architecture patrons because of their professional positions, is inestimable, and Santomasso's spin-off at Columbia had much the same effect. However, unlike the prolific Scully, Santomasso published very little. Thus, he did not get tenure at Columbia, despite his legions of enthusiastic students who, in time-honored Columbia fashion, held demonstrations to protest the tenure rejection, but to no avail. However, we, who were set on our architectural career paths, thanks to Jean Santomasso, continue to remember him gratefully, a quarter century after his tragically early death from AIDS at the age of 55. Odd as it may now seem, my graduate art history studies at Columbia convinced me that I myself would never succeed in academia because of an inability to write in accordance with accepted scholarly convention. Thus, after taking a master's degree and feeling sure that I'd never be able to write a doctoral dissertation, I went into publishing. First at Columbia's Teachers College Press, a kind of academy industry halfway house, and then at McGraw-Hill, where I became editor of its book division at Architectural Record magazine. There I compiled several collections of historical writings for the Record over the years by Frank Lloyd Wright and by Lewis Mumford, and rejected many proposals for memoirs by architects idled during the stagflation recession of the mid-1970s. Finally, certain that I could produce better prose than the drivel I was required to edit, I began writing book reviews for Architectural Record, which in turn led to my being hired away as an associate editor by its principal rival, Progressive Architecture. There, my work caught the eye of S.I. Newhouse Jr., the board chairman of Condé Nast Publications, whose wife had been taking architectural history classes at Columbia under my wife, whom I married in 1978. Newhouse, with whom we began to socialize, somehow thought I would be of help at House and Garden, the high-end home decorating magazine he wanted to take even more upscale to compete with the increasingly successful Architectural Digest. With the clueless arrogance of youth, I had just turned 30, I kept declining his successively more generous job offers, not realizing that saying no was catnip to a tycoon unaccustomed to rejection. To overcome my resistance, I enlisted Condé Nast's snakily charming editorial director, Alexander Lieberman, to persuade me to follow his own example and make the company what he called my cafe, as he put it, a lucrative day job to underwrite my parallel but underpaid writing career in much the same way he leveraged his powerful position to advance an alternative identity as a painter and sculptor. I took his advice, wrote for many other publications, including Art in America, and thus began my three-decade up-and-down ride on the Condé Nast carousel. But in hindsight, all of that pales to insignificance compared to the phone call that came out of the blue in 1985, when the late Robert B. Silvers, the legendary founding co-editor of the New York Review of Books and widely considered the foremost literary editor of modern times, asked if I would like to write about Ida Louise Huxtable's new book, The Tall Building Artistically Reconsidered, The Search for a Skyscraper Style, the study she produced as a MacArthur Fellow. I, of course, instantly said yes. Contributing to this august journal was beyond even my grandiose imagination. However, as I began to read Huxtable's text, my heart sank, for despite having first learned about architecture at her knee, as it were, I thought she was out of her depth as a historian. I said so with great regret in my piece, which Bob Silvers ran without any major changes, and it was such a mutually satisfactory experience, except for Ada Louise, I suppose, that I soon became a regular contributor to the New York Review. It was only as we approached the review's 50th anniversary year that I asked Bob why he invited me to write for him in the first place, to which he replied, "Oh, I thought you knew that. Ada Louise recommended you." From then until she died in 2013 at 91, I inserted praise of her into any possible piece where I could belatedly demonstrate my gratitude to this historic figure. Given the wholesale reconsideration of the modern movement in architecture that was underway in the 1980s, when postmodernism was being promoted as a return to age-old values preferable to the allegedly worn-out late international style, Bob asked me to embark on an informal but ongoing series of monographic career assessments of the great makers of modern architecture. Over the ensuing 3.5 decades, this project has grown to encompass more than 60 essays of about 4,000 to 6,000 words each. They have been collected in 3 volumes, all titled Makers of Modern Architecture, and respectively subtitled From Frank Lloyd Wright to Frank Gehry, From Le Corbusier to Rem Koolhaas, and From Antoni Gaudí to Maya Lin. The dust jacket of the most recent volume, published last September, pleases me especially because it features not only a woman architect, but an Asian-American woman architect, Maya Lin, a sign of greater diversity in the profession since I began writing about it. From the outset of my career, I have been acutely aware of the disparity between highly visible men and often invisible women in architectural practice, a perception that can only grow when one is married to such a staunch second-wave feminist as my wife. For example, my early review pieces on the first generation modernists whose centennials were being observed in the 1980s included extended asides on the women who worked in close but unacknowledged collaboration with them. Lily Reich, the longtime co-worker and mistress of Ludwig Mies van der Rohe, actually created the celebrated minimalist interiors for his works of the 1920s and 1930s. Charlotte Perriand was greatly responsible for the furniture, often solely attributed to Le Corbusier, and was romantically involved with his partner and cousin, Pierre Jeanneret, much to Corbusier's envy. Ina Aalto, the trained architect wife and chief partner of Alvar Aalto, was so crucial to his early success that his work was never as good after she died in 1949 at the age of 54 as it had been before. More extensive accounts of women architects appear in my later review essays on Margareta Schutte-Lehotsky, Gerdy Trost, Lena Bobardi, Ray Eames, Denise Scott Brown, Kazuo Sejima, Billy Chin, Elizabeth Diller, and Maya Lin. All the same, it is clear from the disparity in the sheer numbers between my female and male subjects that there is still a long way to go before we can say that women architects are being equal, are being paid equal attention in the press. Looking back now on my 45-year publishing career, distinct patterns emerge. One that seems self-evident is how avant-garde American architects have fared so much better at a safe remove from New York. In that regard, I think of a line from Frederick Raphael's witty screenplay for John Schlesinger's 1965 film satire, Darling, which characterizes London as, quote, that damn jam factory boiling the goodness out of writers. No less so, I feel that New York is that damn trash compactor crushing the goodness out of architects. A corrupting commercialism has always dominated the profession in New York, America's financial capital from the very beginning, and has become even more pernicious with each ensuing century and decade. I doubt that the most important American architects of the second half of the 20th century, who in my opinion are Louis Kahn, Robert Venturi, and Denise Scott Brown, and Frank Gehry, could have achieved what they did had they been based in New York rather than, respectively, Philadelphia, and Los Angeles. There they were free to pursue their idiosyncratic paths because of supportive local cultures that had already given significant support to maverick masters, Frank Furness in the case of Philadelphia, and experimental architects too numerous to mention in the case of Los Angeles, with much less emphasis on high profit as the chief goal of architecture. Kahn and the Venturis also benefited from Vincent Scully's advocacy of their singular importance, which effectively made their careers a back-to-back feat achieved by no other architecture historian or critic. How remarkable that Scully could embrace both the high-minded aspirations of Kahn, who wanted to supplant the denatured late international style with a timeless grandeur akin to that of classical antiquity, but also Venturi and Scott Brown's controversial insistence that America's commercial roadside vernacular offers an untapped source of inspiration for high-style architecture. As for Frank Gehry, during the 1970s, my colleagues at Progressive Architecture and I were just as convinced of his preeminence as Scully had been of Kahn's in the 1950s and the Venturis in the 1960s. We published Gehry's early work before any other national magazine, including his famously deconstructed house in Santa Monica, which appeared on PA's cover more than two decades advance of his becoming an overnight international sensation with his Guggenheim Museum Bilbao at the age of 68. However, we were equally sure that Gary would never become a popular figure like Frank Lloyd Wright, whose advanced but always engaging architecture remains as perennially beloved by the general public as it is revered by his fellow professionals. Instead, we at PA expected that the architectural superstar of the 20th century's last quarter would be the Princeton-based Michael Graves. With his ingratiating blend of nostalgic classical imagery and jazzy collaging. But Graves had difficulty in producing large-scale buildings of coherence and distinction, to say nothing of a tendency towards kitsch, as seen here in one of his regrettable Walt Disney World hotels. His lopsided concentration on highly profitable but trivial household product design ultimately pushed him off the radar screens of many critics, myself included. Graves was embittered by that fall off in press attention well before he was paralyzed by a spinal cord infection in 2003, which prompted him to turn his practice towards accessible design for the disabled. He excelled at that during his last dozen years, and he redeemed his reputation by the time he died at 80. In contrast, Gary, who turned 90 in February, learned how to tone down the subversive punk elements of his breakthrough designs of the 1970s. He eliminated the low-rent stigmata of chain-link fencing, chicken wire glass, and corrugated metal in favor of costlier materials like his hallmark titanium. But in that process of refinement, his finished work lost none of its vitality, which he has likened to the immediacy of a conceptual sketch. His influence as a before and after force in architecture has been achieved by only a tiny handful of other modern master builders, including Wright, Le Corbusier, and one or two others. But what exactly makes certain architects so much more important than their contemporaries? In brief, there are very few who have achieved that rarest of creative feats, making us see the world through fresh eyes, an extraordinary phenomenon in any art form, let alone in the slow-moving, problem-plagued, and compromise-ridden medium of architecture, where there are countless more restraints and compromises than in painting, sculpture, and the performing arts. Ezra Pound famously said that literature is news that stays news, and I feel the same about the work of many of the architects I've discussed tonight. They share one quality despite many differences. Their old work looks perpetually contemporary, a foolproof indicator to me of artistic genius. As for my own daily experience of architecture, on weekdays, Rosemary and I live in a mid-century modern high-rise on Manhattan's Upper East Side, designed by the quite competent commercial architect Lathrop Douglas in a style we call sub-Marcel Breuer because of its conjoined double-wide floor plan, so characteristic of Breuer's late work. Although it's been our home for 34 years, we doubt that it will survive for another 34, standing just a few hundred feet away from the East River and separated from it only by the FDR Drive. It was seriously damaged in 2012 by Superstorm Sandy. The basement was so deeply flooded that all the mechanical systems were wrecked by salt water from the East River, which is actually an estuary, and it took 6 weeks to fully restore all the building services. We nervously await the next storm of the century of the decade. However, unlike most victims of the natural disasters that are unfolding with frightening frequency worldwide because of global warming and climate change, we fortunately have a second home where we could take refuge while our apartment was uninhabitable. This is not it. One of Stanford White's last completed works was his James L. Breeze house of 1897 to 1996 called The Orchard in Southampton, Long Island, a remodeling and expansion of an 18th century farmhouse. It was converted into condominiums in the 1980s and is now listed on the National Register of Historic Places. Small wood frame dwellings for servants and estate workers were erected on the periphery of the 30-acre Breeze estate, including a late shingle-style cottage for the estate's dairyman, built around 1915. For the past 25 years, we have owned the dairyman's cottage and have cultivated its English-inspired garden, which was designed for us by our Columbia art history contemporary, Deborah Nevins, who is now a distinguished landscape architect. At the left, we see an aerial view that shows the green outdoor rooms into which our half-acre property is divided, and on the right is the beach house, a 20-foot square living gazebo made from purple beech, trained and clipped over a wood and wired framework. For me, it has been a very long journey to 39 Breeze Lane in Southampton from 2827 Clinton Street in Camden. It was in my teenage bedroom, which was directly behind the two front windows on the raised first floor, seen in this rain-spotted Google Street View photo, that I plotted in obsessively precise detail the exact adult life that I wished to have, except for my becoming an architecture critic, which even I could not have imagined. Yet with a completeness that never ceases to amaze me, it has all come to pass as if conjured up by a genie. Not least of those magical outcomes has been my being asked to speak to you tonight at John Notman's superb Athenaeum of 1845 to 1847, which long ago caught my eye as some unattainable redoubt of Philadelphia high culture and learning, but which tonight has so graciously welcomed me. Thank you.
Thank you, Martin. It was terrific. Join us all. Martin Filler will be signing books during our reception in the reading room. Thank you for coming. Good evening.
And a quick reminder to our board, we'll have a quick meeting downstairs.